Shabbat Shalom. Does anyone know what day it is today? What's the calendar date? What is it? That's one right answer. It's Independence Day, right? Does anyone know what the day is today on the Jewish calendar? Anyone have any idea? It's actually a very momentous day. It's the day before a very momentous day in Jewish history. Does anyone know the month that we're in? I love to ask these kinds of questions when no one knows them. What month are we in the Jewish calendar? It's actually very important for us to know these things. We are in the month of Tammuz. And during the month of Tammuz, a whole bunch of things happened, okay? On the 17th of Tammuz, does anyone know what happened in Jewish history on the 17th of Tammuz?
Was it the walls
by Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians, the walls of Jerusalem were besieged at this point, and they were penetrated. And 3 weeks later, on the 9th of Av, what happened? Complete destruction. Jerusalem was completely destroyed. The temple was destroyed and caught on fire, burned to the ground. And Israel, those who remained in Jerusalem, were sent into exile. Of the thousands and thousands and thousands of people who had lived in Jerusalem at the time, do you know how many people left in exile? Only about 3,000 actually left Jerusalem. A whole bunch had already left and were already in exile in Egypt and other places. But at this, finally, at the end of all this death and destruction, there were only about 3,000 people who went into exile at that very point. In other words, just a ghost of what Israel had been like finally went into exile. Today, we're kind of intention. What do we celebrate? Do we celebrate Independence Day in the United States? Or do we remember the admonition of the Most High, which actually starts at sunset tonight? The 3 weeks of admonition begin at sunset, 17th of Tammuz. For 3 weeks, we read from the Haftorah portions, really painful portions we'll be reading about the correction of the Most High and what happens when we fail to discern Him in our midst and when we fail to follow Him. And then, of course, after that are what are known as the 7 weeks of repentance, where we read mostly from the servant songs in Isaiah about the return of the Messiah. So we have the 7 weeks of comfort following the 3 weeks of admonition. And today, I kind of want to talk about not the independence part, although I recognize that's important. It's an important part of American history. But on the other hand, has anyone followed the news in the last few months in the United States? It's a really interesting times that we live in, aren't they? Very momentous events, and it would be, I think, a dereliction of my duty if I were not to at least mention them, because these events are overcoming us very quickly. They're having a profound influence in our personal lives and our communal lives. These things that have happened in the last few days and weeks, really months leading up to these momentous Supreme Court decisions, will start affecting us as believers in very personal ways. Just today, or I guess it was yesterday, in Oregon, a Christian bakery refused to actively participate in a same-sex wedding. Everyone knows this story, right? Or maybe no one does. Sweet Cakes Bakery. And so the Oregon Department of Labor fined them $135,000 because they essentially, by refusing to participate in this gay wedding, performed mental rape upon this same-sex couple. That's the final ruling. They have to pay $135,000 because they decided not to actively participate a same-sex wedding. The world has changed, is what I'm saying. The world has changed. We are no longer living in utopia, if we ever did. I know that when the Puritans moved to what became the United States, their desire was to build a new Jerusalem from sea to shining sea, or at least from one shining sea all the way to the Appalachian wilderness or something like that. Their vision may not have extended to the Pacific Ocean, but ours did, beyond that. This was seen as a wonderful, wonderful New Jerusalem type of a place where we could live, and it would be a nation derived on godly values and all of this. And we know this. This is what we celebrate Independence Day when we celebrate that. But that's not my main topic. My main topic is not even all of the events that are happening, although we need to be aware of them because they will affect us. But what is our response? How should we view ourselves living in a country where now we have laws that essentially tell me that I have to actively participate in things that God says are not good in order to be a proper citizen? 100 years ago or so, 150 years ago, our country was enmeshed in slavery, and we had a civil war. The North won, slavery was abolished, and then in the 1960s we had the essentially a revolution, a civil rights revolution, and properly so, blacks and whites were considered equal in our society, like they should have been from the beginning. But now that concept of civil rights has been extended to lifestyle choices. To people who wake up one morning and decide, I'm no longer a person, I'm a dog, or I'm no longer a male, I'm a female. And we have to affirm those, and if we don't, we're in danger of violating civil rights. And so my whole point is that the world has changed for us as believers. And how should we conduct ourselves? How should we view ourselves in the light of these things? So the title of my sermon on the 4th of July, 2015 is not celebrating independence, but it is entitled Living in the Galut. How do we live in exile? A couple of examples from the contemporary press. Let me read these titles here. On the one side, now is the time to end tax exemptions for religious institutions. This was June 28, 2015. So now the New York Times is advocating that as a religious institution, we lose our tax exemptions because we're now hateful bigots. We're no longer involved in proper civil rights. The government shouldn't be subsidizing us. Two that I like that I think will launch into the topic that I want to talk about. This came from Time magazine on the 26th of June. The title is Orthodox Christians must now learn to live as exiles in our own country. I think this is actually a very encouraging title. We need to be encouraged to learn to live as exiles in our own country. This is not God's country. That's in Idaho, by the way. That's not here. That's, you know, the mountains. That was a joke. This is actually smack in the middle of what the Bible calls the world of sin and death, and we're surrounded by it. And we've perhaps fooled ourselves over the years to think that we're no longer living in exile, but we're actually in the New Jerusalem. This is the place where people come to, where they get freedom, where they get prosperity. And for many years, the United States has been seen as that sort of a country where people come to. There were more Jews who immigrated to the United States then immigrated to Israel throughout the years, because the United States were seen as this is the place where real freedom and prosperity could happen. In fact, for many years in Israel itself, there were more people immigrating from Israel to the United States than there were from the rest of the world to Israel until very, very recently. So we have been seen as God's country in a lot of ways. But that is no longer the case, and I think it's important for us to square our views and our attitudes and our actions with the new reality. We are now exiles in our own country. And then one other article says, yes, exile in response to this, but engaged exiles. How do we go about being exiles, being separate from a country that is slowly turning to evil, if it hasn't been for a long time, and yet being engaged in the larger culture? How do we go about doing that? That's really the topic that I want to speak about tonight, or this morning. I guess it's, I got up at midnight, I guess, to get ready for this. I want to speak about that today. Living in the Galut, living in exile. How do we go about living in exile? James 1 gives us a start for this. Does anyone know what it says in James 1 at the very beginning? Consider it all joy, my brethren, when money just pours from... No, wait. Maybe I better read it carefully. No. Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials and temptations. Because these are the things that God wants for us to have. He says these are the things, the afflictions that the world brings are the things that turn us to the Most High and give us strength in Him. So when we look at the destruction of our moral society, when we look at the turning of our society into things that God considers to be evil, that they are calling good, we need to consider it all joy. How do we respond? We don't respond in despair, but we respond with joy. We are to live as aliens. We are to live and considering ourselves to be aliens. Hebrews 11, verse 3, and 1 Peter 2, 11 and 12 speak very clearly about that. We consider ourselves today to be aliens on the face of the earth. We are strangers, we're sojourners with the Messiah on the face of the earth. Wherever we are, we're surrounded by darkness. And yet we're supposed to, as Peter tells us, we're supposed to consider ourselves that way, 1 Peter 2:11. But in 2:12, we're told, keep your conduct excellent in the face and in the presence of the Gentiles, the nations, so that when they slander you for your good behavior, he says this very specifically, when they slander you and they attack you for your good behavior, ultimately they will come to glorify God. How do I put it? All of this trouble that is coming upon us has been planned by the Most High for our good. But we have to have the right attitude. And so what I want to do is speak a little bit about the galut. This is the Hebrew word for exile, not the ge'ulah or the redemption, living in the land. We don't live in the land today. We don't live in a utopia. And very often I think that we've had these fantasies that somehow... either the U.S. or wherever we lived, or maybe even the land of Israel, would be transformed into this wonderful land of utopia and everything, you know, land flowing with milk and honey. And we read from the future, the Messianic age, where the lion will lay down with the lamb and all of this. Well, it's a hard thing to be informed and to be reminded that that is not the case today anywhere on the face of the earth, not even in Israel. Israel is not the land where God is present in a very real case. If anyone's ever visited Tel Aviv, they'll know this. Okay, it's kind of the worldwide center of the Gay Pride movement, if you didn't know that. And so when the Messiah returns and things in the world change, one thing will be there that is not today, or will not be there that is there today. The enemy will be bound. For 1,000 years, we're told, he'll be bound and will no longer influence the nations. But after that time, the enemy will return, he'll be released, and he will once again deceive the nations. And in both of those situations, before and after, there's a lot of turmoil. People simply don't know right from wrong when there's an enemy out there who deceives us. And the whole world right now is his domain. So I want to talk about this. As we prepare for the 3 weeks of admonition, how do we respond as a community? How did we do this previously in the United States? Well, does anyone remember the days of the moral majority? Jerry Falwell started Liberty University and began to synthesize politics with Christian values. The whole idea is, well, if we just get engaged enough and we elect the right people, we elect the right legislators, and they appoint the right judges, then everything will be wonderful. And for many years, this has kind of been the focus of many in the religious right, shall we say. Let's turn the country into, you know, the flag and serving God are essentially the same thing. Well, we're living the consequences of that. It didn't work, is my point. It simply didn't work. The consequences of that is we're now exiles. The Puritans tried this with the New Jerusalem, and the effect of that were the Salem witch trials. A lot of good attitudes, a lot of good ideas ended up going wrong. People end up being oppressed who aren't fitting in with their idea of utopia. There are other examples. On the religious left, there is this dream of bringing about social justice in the whole world. But again, that does not take into account the fact that this world is owned lock, stock, and barrel and operated by Satan Incorporated. He owns it. We're told this very clearly. Who owns this domain? The whole world is his domain. It's the Prince of Darkness. And of course, we battle against the Prince of Darkness. We don't battle against people. We battle against the Prince of Darkness. But this is the stage that God has given us as his people. We are exiles among the earth. The land today, this may be a shock. It's probably even heresy. So don't throw tomatoes at me, okay, because that they spot, okay. The land today does not belong to the people of Israel. Does anyone know this? It was never given to Israel. The land actually belongs to the Most High, and the people of Israel were told very clearly, this is in Leviticus 25, verse 23, you are strangers and aliens with me on the land. You cannot buy and sell the land itself. You can only buy and sell the value of the crops and the produce from the land up until the year of Jubilee. And then everything reverts back to who God says is going to live on it. And he says, the reason for this is the land is mine, it's not yours, and you are strangers and sojourners with me on the earth. This is the attitude that we need to have in our communities today. The kingdom of heaven is not a geographical location. The kingdom of heaven is where God's people are. And he says that I am a stranger with you on the face of the earth because the domain of the earth is still in the enemy's territory. So what I want to do is bring a few pictures from Joshua and the Judges that help us understand our relationship today in the kingdom of heaven on earth with the darkness and how we need to orient our thinking and our attitudes and our actions so that we can effectively work in the kingdom of heaven as God designed us to do it, not inventing our own way. Because when we make it up as we go, we usually get in trouble. So where is the kingdom of heaven? We've already established that it is not the land of Israel. We're going to look a little bit and see what the land of Israel is supposed to be, why, how it's represented in the Bible, and how we can today take lessons from that. Those of us who don't live there, even those who do live there. In fact, I was speaking with a friend who spoke here recently who lives in the land. Ephraim Goldstein, remember him? And I suggested to him that the believers in the land today, they're small, there aren't that many. They're considered a fringe group by the rest of the population and by the government of Israel. And in many ways, they are a fringe group. They don't have a large voice. So maybe the believers in the land ought to themselves see themselves as exiles in a foreign land that's mostly hostile to them. Instead of thinking that, well, this land is our land. I think there's a song about that, right? Much like we have done for many years in the United States, thinking this is our land, this is God's country. It's not. It's populated by the enemy. And the land of Israel is surrounded by the enemy. And we need to view ourselves as strangers and aliens and exiles, building a kingdom that doesn't have geographical boundaries, but it's real nonetheless. It's a kingdom of light surrounded by darkness. And interestingly, the Bible gives us this very picture with Israel as what I like to say, our model home. Israel is a picture, an example for us today of what the kingdom of heaven should look like on the face of the earth. And so we want to kind of go through this. So the kingdom of heaven, if we look at Israel moving into the land, and actually this week's Torah portion, Balak, occurred just before they were to move into the land. Did you guys realize that? The end of Numbers is actually after the 40 years. They're now encamped on the plains of Moab, just across from Jericho. And they're getting ready and prepared to move into the land. And of course, the enemy doesn't want this, and so the enemy brings his own seers and his own prophets and his own kings to move against the people of Israel. And the enemy tried to move against Balaam. And as we read with Balaam and Balak, they conspired, and yet the Lord intervened supernaturally and directly so that Israel could eventually move into the land. So that's kind of where I want to pick up our tale. We don't read very much of Joshua or the Judges in our reading cycles. We very rarely, if ever, I don't think there's a single Haftorah portion from the Judges or from Joshua. Is there? Does anyone know? I don't think there is. So unless we read outside of the normal reading cycle, we rarely jump into these parts of the Bible. But I think they're very important, and they give us some very important instruction for us today living in the exile. When Israel was to move into the land, the promised land, what do we know about the promised land? It's populated by seven nations, six nations. The Canaanites, actually more than that, a number of those, okay? But all of these groups of people who were descended from Canaan, who were under a multi-generational curse from the Most High. And they themselves made very explicit decisions and lifelong and intergenerational, multi-generational decisions to turn away from the Most High and do their own thing. Kind of like Sodom and Gomorrah, which were actually a part of the land of Canaan, or Nineveh. There's a lot of wind up here, isn't there? Or maybe it's just my hot air. I don't know. where was I? Oh, I was in the land of Canaan, full of people who had chosen to turn away from the Most High. God gave them some 400 years to repent and return, and they chose not to. And these people knew it when Israel was standing at the border there of Jericho, as they were getting ready to cross over the Jordan. All the nations knew what Israel was about. Has anyone ever picked up on this in the Bible? So Jericho was shut up tightly. How come? It wasn't a hurricane. It wasn't tornadoes, and it wasn't a thunderstorm coming. They were shut up tightly, and they were in absolute terror of the people of Israel, because God said, you're going to move into this land, and he said, I will displace the inhabitants. And in fact, at the end of Joshua and the beginning of Judges, we're told that when Israel moved into the land, they essentially didn't have to do any fighting. God did it all for them. He said, I'm the one who removed them from before you missed, and you hardly had to pick up a sword. You had to pick up your sword, you had to be ready, but I did the work for you. So the first point is that they were moving into an incredibly evil part of the world. And in fact, this was the epitome of the darkest part of human nature, the darkest part of the world. This is where the enemy was strongest. Why did God do this? Why didn't he choose something else? Why didn't he choose, well, North America, which didn't have anyone there almost, right? It was very sparsely populated, would have been no one there. But no, God deliberately chose to put his kingdom, his people, to carve out their own territory or their own place of living right smack in the middle of the deepest darkness of the world. That's what we're called to do. That's what we're called to be as a people. We're supposed to recognize that we're surrounded by darkness. When the Messiah is praying for his disciples, this is in John 17, he's praying to his Father, beautiful prayer. Has anyone read that recently? It's a beautiful prayer where he prays for his disciples. He said, Father, I'm leaving, but they're still in the world. And he said, so I want you to send them a comforter. Send them someone who will assist them, who is like me, the Spirit of God, the Holy Spirit. And his job will be threefold. We talked about this actually last night in our study at home. He will give us power. He will bring remembrance of the words that the Messiah spoke to the disciples, and he will teach us. Those are the three things that the Spirit of God gives us. So that we know that when we're a community that is dedicated to the service of the Most High, that even though we don't see him, the Messiah is not here today, but he's here. He's not here, but he sent a presence so that we'd be reminded that the presence of God is still with us. And as a result, we have to be like the Israelites were. The center of our community is the Most High, and we look to him for our instruction. This is where our power comes from. This is where our ability to live in darkness comes from. So he's praying, and he says, Father, give them your comforter. Send your Spirit. But then he also says, where I am going, they can't come. He's leaving to prepare a place for us. And Thomas said, well, if you're going, what's going to happen to us? Because we don't know the way. And the Messiah said, you're right. You don't know the way. You can't go where I'm going. But he said, I'll send someone to you so that you can do my work. In fact, if you take advantage of this, that's maybe not the right word. We don't manipulate the Spirit of God. But if we dwell in him, he says, you'll do greater things than I have done. I don't think we believe that very well. We don't see that very often, but this is something we should expect, that we will do greater things when we have the Spirit of God with us as we go into darkness. So that's my other point. He said, Father, don't take them out of the world, because to remove them from the influence of the enemy would be to take them from the world, because the whole world is his domain. But he said, rather, I want to send my Spirit to protect them. To protect them, because I'm sending them into the darkness. So we shouldn't pray that the darkness would be removed. We should be praying for God's power and protection as we move into the darkness, because that's where we've been sent. We haven't been sent to utopia. We have been sent into the darkness. This is in John chapter 17. So social justice won't save us. The right politicians won't save us, because that is all the domain of the enemy. Until the Messiah removes the enemy, those forces will remain, and we have to realize that. So like Israel, we stand moving into, we're being sent into some of the darkest places on the face of the earth. And God says, that's where you belong. I'm sending you into darkness. But when we're there, we're supposed to build communities where we consider ourselves in exile. This isn't our home. We're in exile. And we need to recognize that however nice it is, however we're at, another rabbi friend of mine once said about 2 years ago, we were talking about the exile, and his response was, yeah, but this is the best exile ever. We need to be careful not to let those attitudes control us. And he understood this, because just a few months later, he gave a talk at a regional conference from Micah about those of us who are in the exile and what our job is. We bring blessings. We bring wonderful things to the communities that we live in. And in fact, those who were sent into exile after the destruction of the temple, what did Jeremiah tell them to do? Seek the good, you and I actually talked about that just a few days ago. Seek the goodness of the land. Don't seek their destruction. Don't think that this is only temporary, but you're stuck here. Settle down, build your communities, and seek to bring blessing to the land that you're in. We should seek as a people to bring blessing to those who are in darkness. They are not our enemy. Remember who the real enemy is. The real enemy is not people who are opposed to God. The real enemy is spiritual. The one behind this, that is the behind the curtain, that is moving in people's hearts and deceiving them and blinding them. That's our warfare. It's not against people. And very often I think we mistake this by attacking the very people who are in darkness, in which we should learn rather to find ways to be a blessing to them. So what does God's peace look like? There's some misconceptions about what peace looks like. I just want to outline a few of these things. What does God's peace really look like? Because he told us that when we move into dark places, he says, you'll be carving out a kingdom where you'll be living. And in your kingdom, there's light. There's God's presence. You're on holy ground. This is why we have bare feet. Our feet have to be prepared for the bringing of the gospel because we're on holy ground. We're in God's presence. But very often, we make mistakes about what peace really looks like because the Most High told us, the Messiah told us, he says, I'm leaving you with peace. But it's not the kind of peace that the world looks for or has. It's a supernatural peace. In fact, he went so far as to say, in this world, you'll have troubles, but take heart. I have overcome the world. We will have troubles when we go into the world, when we are part of the world, when we're engaged in darkness. We'll have troubles and trials and tribulations. So peace is not the absence of conflict. It is not merely the absence of conflict. And many people today are teaching that real peace is the absence of conflict. So when people have conflict, what do? We just remove the source of the conflict. If people say, this lifestyle is right and you're saying it's wrong, there's a conflict there. So what do? Well, we'll say it's right. So it removes conflict. That's not what God's peace is about. If we do not judge, then everything's okay. I've been told this just in the last couple of weeks. If we don't judge people, then there's no conflict. So quit bothering them. Just accept and affirm in all of this. And then we'll have peace. There are no standards. So justice is all about me. That's by the way, the new concept of liberty from the Supreme Court. Justice and liberty, it's all about my personal self-expression. And this is the ultimate thing. So it's all about me. This is a false conception of how we bring about peace. The presence of God must mean universal peace. And in fact, my people, our people, the Jewish people, have labored under that misconception for centuries. How will we know that the Messiah is here? Well, there's universal peace. See, it says in Joel, in Isaiah, in Jeremiah, in Ezekiel, in all of these prophets, in Amos, that when the Messiah comes, everyone will have his own fig tree. And everybody will live until well past 100, and there will be no conflict. And so since the Messiah is not here yet, obviously, because there's conflict in the world, there's no peace. But that's not what the Messiah was speaking about. This is not what peace looks like. It's not going to be universal. The peace of God actually means managing conflict. Utopia is often associated with the coming of the Messiah. He will only bring peace. He will only bring lack of conflict. But yet, we're told that actually, when the Messiah is with us, he says, I didn't come to bring peace. He said, actually, I came to bring conflict. And you will have conflict even from within your own families. They'll throw you out of the synagogues. They'll think that they're doing God a favor by destroying you. This is God's idea of peace for his people. It's not the kind of peace that the world brings. So we need to be seeking the right kind of peace, not necessarily the absence of conflict. And in fact, God tells us that these two kingdoms, the kingdom of heaven and the world of sin and death, they're kingdoms that are in mortal conflict. And we are to be organized. In fact, Israel, this is the picture we're given. When Israel was encamped just in front of Moab, what did they look like? They weren't just a mob. That was coming out of Egypt. They were a mob, right? But God organized Israel into what? Into a military camp. Very, very clearly, it was a military camp. It was designed for conflict. God was in the center. You had the priests and you had the Levites and their families around them. And then
very strategically placed around the tabernacle were all of the tribes. And when they left in order, just like a military unit does. When they camp in a particular order. And so you can't escape the fact that Israel was designed to be a military unit. In the kingdom of heaven, we prepare for war. And in fact, in Ephesians chapter 6, this has been the topic of a few sermons here in the past. What is the believer supposed to be garbed in? Instruments that essentially deal with war. Now, of course, the common, what I think is a misunderstanding, is that this is the picture of a Roman soldier. Maybe. I think there's a better picture, and Paul gives us a better picture of that, of which fortunately our own congregational leader, George, has recognized this. Those are actually pictures of two things. The high priest's clothing, every one of the articles that are spoken of in Ephesians chapter 6 actually are on the high priest. Paul doesn't even quote the passages about the high priest, though. In every case, he quotes passages about the Messiah himself. And when he returns, this is what he looks like. Our clothing is not to be worldly implements of war. Our clothing is to be supernatural implements of war. We clothe ourselves in the Messiah himself. And he says, these are the things that I will use for you to effectively wage war against the darkness. Because, again, the war is not the people. The war are the spiritual components that we don't often perceive, but he says this is where our war lies. And so we're prepared for that. So our conflict, Ephesians 6, 11 and 12, and Ephesians 2, 2, make it very clear. Our conflict is not worldly. It's spiritual. It's supernatural. So we are to know conflict in his kingdom. Luke 12, 51 and 52 tells us very clearly, and several others in John, in Matthew, and in other places in Luke, that we are prepared for conflict. Very clearly, our lives are prepared for conflict with the enemy. But what is our task? What are we to bring? We don't bring fighting with people. Our task is actually to bring peace. It's a peace that the world doesn't know. John 14, 27, John 16, 33, Philippians 4, 7. The peace that God brings is a peace that surpasses understanding. And when people are in darkness, see us, they recognize that we have peace with one another and we have peace with God inside our communities. But at the same time, at the interface, we have conflict. I got to speak here about a year ago, about this time last year. And I spoke on the Beatitudes in Luke chapter 6. Does anyone remember those? I remember because I spoke, but probably no one else does. The point of the Beatitudes is that there was a contrast. Blessed are you who mourn. Blessed are you who are poor. Blessed are you who seek and hunger after God. You'll be rewarded. What were the woes on the other side of that? Woe to you who are well fed. Woe to you that are happy now. Woe to you when everyone speaks well of you and they pat you on the back and say, what a wonderful person you are. The Messiah said, we need to be prepared for conflict. Blessed are you when men castigate you and slander you and cast you out and attack you, for great is your reward in heaven when this happens. And so when we look for peace, peace is not necessarily just the absence of conflict with people, but rather we're a military encampment. Or we do wage war against the spiritual forces. We don't wage war against the people who are caught up in darkness. Our task to them is actually to bring peace. We're known as peacemakers, Matthew 5, 9. Blessed are the peacemakers. Blessed are those who bring peace. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven. So we seek to bring peace to people, not the absence of conflict, but rather reconciliation between God and man. That is the good news. That's the essence of our gospel, is we announce peace. We announce that God no longer wants to strive with us, but wants to be reconciled with us. And so that's our task, is to bring that kind of peace. It's not as the world knows. And we need to be careful to not mistake, we don't want to mistake conflict with worldly values with the lack of peace. Because the kind of peace that God brings says that we will come into conflict with those kinds of values. So it's not the same as no conflict in our lives. All right, so let's take a look at Joshua. Okay, as I said before, Israel, in my view, the whole story of Israel throughout the Bible is essentially a model home for us. It's an example for us. And I've spoken before about this. Israel is our example that we look to understand what the kingdom of heaven today should look like. So we can gain knowledge, we can gain encouragement, we can gain instruction from the example of Israel. Now, sometimes we have to be a little bit midrashic in pulling these things out, but that's the whole reason we do sermons, so that we can take lessons for today. Paul made it very clear, these things were written for our instruction. Don't follow the poor example of Israel in the wilderness, where they were always double-minded and turning away from God, but rather focus on the Most High very clearly and very, very devotedly follow Him. And so these things were written as instructions. Everything that was written beforehand, we're told, is written, this is in Hebrews, we're told that everything that was written beforehand was for our instruction upon whom the end of the ages has come. So let's take lessons from the history of Israel, both the good and the bad, so that we can learn to properly identify as God's people in a world that is where we're surrounded by darkness. How do we build our communities in such a way that we don't make the same mistakes that Israel did? We don't mix with the nations, but at the same time, we engage with those who want to draw near. And so we see a number of examples of this. So let's take a look at Joshua. Joshua 1, 7 and 8. This is the charge that is given to Israel. Be strong and courageous. Hang in there. Be strong. Don't have any fear. We're crossing over. What happened 40 years before this? People were ready to cross over, and terrible news came out of that. The Anakim are there. The children of Anak, the Nephilim, the scary monsters from our legends of our past are populating the land, and there's no way that we can overcome them. And because of that, Israel turned in fear, and they said, no, let's kill these guys and appoint a new leader and get us back to Egypt where it's safe and secure. And we know the rest of the history. They spent 40 years in the wilderness to learn what it means to not listen to the Most High and not trust in Him. So Joshua, who was one of those two spies, Joshua and Caleb were the two who brought a good report. And they're clearly, he's remembering back, he's saying, don't be like these people before. Don't be like your parents, that previous generation. Be strong and courageous. We don't have a spirit of fear in our communities. What happens when we look at the dark forces arrayed against us? We shouldn't have a spirit of fear, but we should have a spirit of courage, of strength and courageousness. So Joshua tells us, be strong. We need to be prepared in the same way. Luke 1:74 is an example. We need to have that strength. John 4:18. Don't have fear. Perfect love casts out all fear. Now, here's another interesting thing. In the 1980s, in the middle of this moral majority stuff, and you know, the church transcendent in the United States, a very popular preacher in Texas said this, and I actually saw this on a billboard. He said, put God to work for you in this divinely ordered capitalistic society. Is this an attitude that we're supposed to have? Are we supposed to put God to work for us? Joshua is given very, very clear instruction about this. So he is preparing to move across the Jordan. They get across there, and immediately they encounter a spiritual being, right? Joshua didn't quite understand this, so he came up to this guy who was very clearly, he had an army behind him, and he said, well, are you for us or are you for our enemies? And what was the answer? Neither. Wrong question. The captain of the Lord's army said, neither. I'm neither for you, and I'm not for your enemies. But the question is, are you for me? Do we put God to work for us? Do we see God as this talisman, good luck charm, where we put him to work in our lives, and as long as we do the right things, then he'll bring blessing and all kinds of nice things to us? This example with Joshua was, no, we don't have that attitude. Are we on God's side, or is he on our side? The reality is we should be on God's side. I have a quotation that I need to quote, and I may not have written it down. Yes, I did. More often than not, we have placed our trust in all these things that we think puts God on our side. But Abraham Lincoln, it's the 4th of July, I have to quote him, right? he put it this way. He said, sir, my concern, this is at the advent of the Civil War, he said, sir, my concern is not whether God is on our side. My greatest concern is to be on God's side, for God is always right. That should be our heart. Joshua was told, he was corrected, I'm not on your side. God is not on our side. God is for God. And we can sign up for him and follow him, or we can go our own ways. And so Joshua was corrected right at the beginning. The Lord's army is there, but it's not for your service. You are to be in God's service. That's our first attitude when we enter into the kingdom of heaven, when we go into the darkness. Are we on God's side, or do we see him on our side? So we can take a lesson from Joshua and from Abraham Lincoln. Our concern is to be on God's side. And so what does that mean practically? That means that God calls the shots. He's the one that makes the rules. In the kingdom of heaven, I'm doing a series, actually. I'm teaching a series and have been and will be again teaching a series on what I call tour guide training for the kingdom of heaven. When we see ourselves in the kingdom of heaven, this isn't our little playground, but rather it's like we're tour guides. When people come in, what are we supposed to do? We're supposed to give them a tour. We're supposed to tell them what it's like to live in the kingdom of heaven. That's our job. Wonderful passage that illustrates this. A real famous passage. Some guy named Philip, remember him? Okay, it's after all these terrible events and great events at Shavuot, and just after that, we're told in Acts, after Stephen dies, the Lord comes to Philip and he says, you need to go to Gaza because I have something for you there. So Philip goes to Gaza and he's looking around and he says, here's this caravan. This must be the place. Of course, the Spirit of God told him, go to this caravan. And he looks in there and who does he see? He sees actually a religious tourist. He was a tourist. He had been to Jerusalem, right? And he was celebrating Passover and Shavuot. And he'd been there doing all of these events, right? And he'd even gone to the souvenir shop and he bought himself a souvenir. We know this. It says it. What was he doing? Reading his souvenir. He was reading the scroll of Isaiah, right? He said, you know, this is a copyrighted copy of the 8th edition or something like that, right? Because it wasn't the original. And so he was reading from the scroll of Isaiah. He was a tourist. And we know he was a tourist because he had this attitude about that. He says, I've been there. And so Philip asked him, he says, hey, do you understand what you're reading? And what was his response? It's a beautiful response. How can I know unless I have a guide? That is our task. To be tour guides for people who are interested in the kingdom. Those in darkness, we're going to talk about this in just a moment, those in darkness are indeed interested in the kingdom of heaven. Their response, though, will not be, it will very rarely be what we would expect or would desire. And we'll look at that in just a moment. But when these tourists come in, our job is to give them a proper story. We don't tell them, hey, there's this really neat geyser that's going to go off every 72 minutes, and if you stick your head down there, you can see it come up. We don't do that, okay? We don't give them the demo version. No, we have to learn the proper story. We have to learn what the kingdom of heaven is really like in order to give people a proper tour of what the kingdom is like. That way, when they come in or they make a decision, it's not under false pretenses. And this is one of my biggest fears today. Yes, I have a lot of fears, but that's one of my biggest fears today, is that in our practicing and learning how to preach the gospel, we give a demo version instead of the real version. We don't tell people what it's really like to live in the kingdom of heaven, because living in the kingdom of heaven is actually terrifying. It is a terrifying thing to fall into the hands of the living God. Therefore, knowing the terror of God, we persuade men. We don't want to give them the Big Rock Candy Mountain version of the kingdom of heaven, where the little streams of alcohol are coming down the rocks. That won't happen until the Messianic Age, when the mountains will drip with sweet wine. Not today. Today, we come in and we're preparing for conflict. We come into the kingdom of heaven, and immediately we have to be concerned about what's in the darkness, because there will be people coming in from the darkness, and they're going to want to bring their values and their attitudes into the kingdom. And that can't happen. Not only should we not allow it, but God won't allow it, because what happens when those values come into the kingdom? Well, we have examples. Okay, what happened at Jericho? Okay, Israel had to go in, and with the sword they had to knock down the walls, and they had bulldozers, and wait, that's the wrong story, right? That's not what happened. Okay, they're told to do something very strange, put the singers out in front, march around the walls, and God did the destroying for them. But there was one small group of people who were inside of Jericho who were under the ban as well, who were cursed, and yet they became part of the kingdom because they recognized where God was, and they said, I want to be there. Okay. What was the next thing that happened right after Jericho? What was the next town that God directed them to? Yes, Ai, actually. It's Ai, as in Oi. And that's how we should remember Oi, or Ai. What happened there? The same thing. They were actually, it was because of something that happened at Jericho that things didn't go well at Ai. There was one family, one person, who saw lots of the value and the gold and the neat things, the shiny things in Jericho, and he took a bunch of them, right? His name was Achan. It's an interesting story. It's been spoken about here before. So Achan really wanted something from Jericho. He wanted something from the world of sin and death. There's the Midrash. There's the picture. The shiny things were neat. And he said, I was really attracted to them. They called to me. I could hear the gold calling to me. And so the gold called to them. And he took some. And what happened at Ai because of that? People died. And the Lord said, there's big trouble here because someone has not listened to me, and they've looked out into the world of sin and death where I said, you have nothing to do with those things and those values. And he said, oh, shiny. I got to have some of them. This happens today in our lives. We look out in the world and we say, wow, there are shiny things out there, and we really need to bring them in and incorporate them. I actually read an article not very long ago where a pastor was advocating that we need to turn to Hinduism and Buddhism in order to learn how to properly worship the Most High, because they have interesting concepts about how to worship God. Well, you need to read the Judges to find out the consequences of those attitudes. Don't mix the shiny things of the world with the things of God. That was the lesson of Achan and I. Don't do that. Don't, even in small measures, don't mix with the values of the world. We have to be careful as we learn to be good tour guides. We have to be careful to learn the proper things to desire. God says, there's a way that seems right to a man, but its end is the way of death. And the response to that the believers have is, trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not to your own understanding, but in all your ways acknowledge him, and he will direct your path. We have to not look to the world and their wisdom in order to build the kingdom of heaven. Their concept of equality and justice is not ours. We follow God. He's not on our side. This was the lesson to Joshua. This was the lesson of I, is that we don't look outward for our comfort and our aid. We look to the Most High alone. And he says, I'll take care of those desires as long as you turn your hearts to me. And so in Joshua, we're taught these are certain things that we simply cannot be involved with. The kingdom of heaven simply does not mix with the values of the world. Where is our treasure? Matthew 6:19-21. Don't seek the treasure of the world because it rusts and moths get in and it gets destroyed and it gets burned up. Things don't last from the world, but rather seek God, seek him, and that's where your treasure is. Where your heart is, there your treasure also will be, the Messiah teaches us. We seek him. We don't seek things. Proverbs 16:16. Is there anything more precious than gold? Yes, the wisdom of the Most High. Your wisdom, Lord, is most desirable. It's even greater than gold and silver. So we seek his wisdom. We don't seek the things of the world. And as we grow our kingdom of heaven in these dark places, we have to come back to those fundamentals, so to speak, where God says, there are values in the world that seem right and they seem good, but they're not my ways. And we won't know them. In fact, the two women of Proverbs 8 and 9, was it? We've been through this in our Torah study. There's the woman of wisdom, and then there's the woman who is not of wisdom but looks a lot like the woman of wisdom and uses the same words. And people follow her, and they don't even know until they're in free fall that her end is death. We have to develop the wisdom to know the right story. And that means we study, we learn about the kingdom of heaven, we learn about God's values, and we realize that our understanding is actually dangerous. When we look and we say, well, this makes sense to me. It makes sense that I have to treat all behaviors as equal. Same-sex marriage, this is the big thing these days, right? Everything's the same. What's the difference? It looks so similar on the outside. They love each other. They do the same things as people who are married. People who decide not to get that stupid piece of paper. These are very relevant to our communities today. Lots and lots of people decide that they're going to act like they're married without getting married. They say, I don't need that stupid piece of paper. And what does God say about that? He says, that's the wisdom of the world, and its end is death. You get the stupid piece of paper, and I'm not denigrating this. This actually the covenant we make with God and with his people when we get married. It's a covenant related. It's a public thing. It's part of the kingdom. And God says, this is my wisdom with marriage. You do this first, and if you short-circuit the process, he says, there are consequences for that. We have to relearn those. They're not difficult to know. What they're difficult to do is stomach. Because our sense, our knowledge from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, leads us in a direction of death. That is the tree of the knowledge of good and evil is the tree of the world of sin and death. What is the tree of life? That's where God is found. We seek him and we seek his knowledge. We say, my understanding is not good enough. I have to come back to the Most High and pick up his understanding. If we're going to be effective tour guides, we have to know God's version of the kingdom of heaven and his version of values. And so I encourage you to study his word, to learn those values. How do we engage people on the outside who say, it just doesn't make sense to me. How in the world could I follow a God who says this? And what I'm doing is the same. And we say, well, you've been to the Torah shop. You have the book. Let's read it together. Let me guide you so you can properly understand. So we need to follow Philip's model. He needs to be a proper tour guide. But in order to do that, we have to have the right tools. We have to have the right spirit. We have to have the right source of our information. And it's not in the world. It's not within me. It's in God and God alone. So we need to learn to follow His guiding. We need to learn to listen to His word. And we need to be steeped in those things. So when people speak to us from the outside and they say, well, why is it that we can't just do whatever we feel like when we come into the kingdom of heaven? We have to be able to give them proper answers. And so it's a big part of my desire for the rest of my life is to help teach people the proper story. Not so that we can argue people into the kingdom, but when tourists come in, and most people who visit, that's what they are, they're tourists. They want to check it out. Is this a place that's good to come to? Is it a place that would be nice to live? We want to give the proper story. Now, what about those coming in? Those who come in, we have to be careful not to try to make them too comfortable. Because when someone comes into the kingdom of heaven, they're not going to like it here because God's values are not the world's values. And when you don't have a new heart, you follow your own understanding. And so it's not a good fit. Anyone who comes into the kingdom has to have a supernatural encounter with the presence of God. God Himself has to turn their hearts to Him and give them of His Holy Spirit and give them a new heart. Remember the promises of the new covenant? I will take away the heart of stone. I'll give you a heart of flesh and put my spirit within you and write my laws on your heart. If that doesn't happen, people will come into the kingdom of heaven and they won't like it. In 2 Corinthians, we're told that we are the aroma of the Messiah. It's one of my favorite passages. It's a guiding passage. We're the aroma of the Messiah. In other words, we smell. So that's the picture that Paul gives. We are the fragrance of the Messiah. And so when people encounter us, they smell something. What do they smell? This is interesting. On the one side, for those who are alive, those who are part of the kingdom, the Messiah is the smell of life itself. This is the most wonderful thing, and nothing that we can think of compared to this. But what about our friends who are on the other side? What do they perceive from that very same thing? Does anyone know? It's the smell of death. People who are not regenerate, who don't have the Spirit of God, they encounter the Messiah, they encounter the kingdom, and it's the smell of death. It's repulsive. So we have a problem, don't we? People come in to the kingdom, they want to visit, and what do they smell? They smell death. What can we do? Well, we can go buy perfume and cover it over so they smell something else. This is what usually happens when we try to sell the gospel to them. Come on in. Yeah, don't worry about that smell. It smells pretty good, actually. But it doesn't. It's the smell of death. And until they have a supernatural encounter with God, they're really not a proper fit. So maybe part of our vocabulary actually needs to be, maybe the kingdom of heaven isn't for you. Can I say that again? Instead of saying, everyone, you know, sign on the line, we should maybe be ready to say, maybe the kingdom of heaven is not for you. Until you decide you want to be on God's side, until you decide you want a new heart, the kingdom of heaven simply won't be a good fit because you'll be fighting against it all the time. And here's the scary thing. In Judges, we'll close with this warning here. In Judges, we're told that as we go into the Judges, the people of Israel decided that all of the shiny things that the Canaanites had, because remember, the Canaanites were not completely destroyed. There were a number of groups within Israel who couldn't remove people. There were others who didn't finish the task, and so little by little they were being driven out, but they weren't completely driven out. And Israel, what did they do? They started to do exactly what God said don't do. Don't mix with the nations. Don't like their shiny things. Don't desire those things. And yet they did. And so all of Judges is a cycle. It starts out with Israel desiring the things from the nations around them. They say, ooh, shiny, I like these things. I want them to be a part of our culture. So they mixed, they intermarried, they mixed with those cultures. They mixed with the religions of the Canaanites. Okay, they even began doing the same sacrifices that the Canaanites were doing. They invented this wonderful god named Molech. Just an awesome god, a great way to worship, right? You take your children and you burn them alive, and the god Molech will now bless you because you've given him a sacrifice. Sacrifice your children, and for you it will be well. That's the voice of the darkness. And Israel said, we like that. We want to mix and match. And so they did. Instead of being a light to the nations, Israel said, we want to be like the nations. And I think that this lesson should guide us when we consider contextualizing our gospel on our story. Be careful, because there's a fine line between speaking a language that someone knows and taking up the things of their idol worship and trying to incorporate them into our life just to make them comfortable. This is what happened in the Judges with Israel. So the cycle begins. They have a desire for the things of Canaan, like Achan and others. And so now they begin to intermingle and intermix, and you can't really tell the difference between Israeli society and the Canaanite societies. And so what happens? What's the next step in the cycle? Has anyone read Judges recently? They fall. They're oppressed. God sells them into the hands of the very people that they were attracted to, and those very people were used to oppress them. Isn't this interesting today? We have a very similar situation today. We have worked very hard, or many parts of the evangelical world has worked very hard to make it comfortable for people of the world to be a part of our community. Ah, let's erase the line. There's no line anymore. You just come in and feel comfortable. We're seeker sensitive. We're sensitive to all of your desires, and we're not going to be judgmental. Just come in and we're going to make you comfortable. Those very people now and their very values, suddenly the tables are turned and they're coming into power in our country, and we're looking forward to oppression by those very people that we were trying to accommodate. Very, very similar to the Judges. So God turns the Jewish people over to be oppressed by Canaanites, by the Philistines, by whoever. There's like 10 different examples of this happening. And it might last for 20, 40, 60 years of where he brings this correction by oppression. And then what happens? Then he raises up a judge. And the judge comes, breaks the power of the enemy, and they're restored back to God. And it would be nice if the story ended there, but it doesn't, because in every single case, with maybe one exception or two, but I didn't read of any, all the judges were flawed. Samson wasn't the greatest person to follow. Barak, does anyone know who Barak was? He was involved with Yael and Deborah, right? He was the commander. He wasn't the greatest person to be emulating, okay? Jephthah, oh, that's a story I don't even want to get into, okay? That's why Judges ends, essentially. Samson was not a good example. Gideon was not a good example. He didn't trust God enough to listen to his word, so he had to test him, not once, but twice. And then even after that, he ends up being ensnared by the very statue that he made to commemorate the great victory. The people fell into idol worship again. So we need to be careful, and the judges are a warning. And I think it's an appropriate warning for us today, as we look to the 3 weeks of admonition and then the 7 weeks of comfort as we head into the fall feast. We need to be reminded that if we turn our kingdom of heaven into a place where everybody's comfortable and their values can come in and mix, and we just can't be judgmental, but, you know, the whole idea is just get people in the door, God himself will take action. We won't have much of a say in it. He'll say, I'll use those very people to oppress you until you turn to me again. And so I would pray that we have clear eyes and we have clear hearts. We need to learn to follow him. We need to learn to build our communities where only the values of the Most High are there. We follow him. He doesn't follow us. We learn to serve him. We need to learn his story and his values, not our own values that masquerade as God's values. Because if we don't, well, God may take action, and I think that we're actually seeing that today. So I want to finish with a couple of verses. Romans 8:37. We should be encouraged. Romans 8:37 tells us that when we're in Him, we overwhelmingly conquer. We've been made more than conquerors, overcomers by His word. We have the victory because of the blood of our Messiah. Paul writes that. In Jude 24, I want to read that passage. And then one more, and then we'll finish. Judah, does anyone remember that? That's one of the longest books of the Bible, right? Yes. Now to Him who can keep you from falling and set you without defect and full of joy in the presence of His Shekinah, to God alone our Deliverer, through Yeshua the Messiah, our Lord, be glory, majesty, power, and authority before all time, now and forever. He is the one that can keep us from falling. He is the one who sets His presence in our midst. And we need to take encouragement in that. We're in dark places. We're in dark times. We have correction probably staring us in the face. But take heart. In this world, John 16:33. I'm going to read that to make sure I get it right here. And then we'll conclude with that. I have said these things to you so that united with me, you may have shalom in the world. In the world you have tsuris. But be brave. I have conquered the world. Be brave. Be strong. Be courageous. In the world, we will have trouble. We'll have all kinds of troubles in the world. But take heart. I have overcome the world.